it's a topic that is near and dear to our hearts because, quite honestly, it's one that almost destroyed our relationship. And the more I think about the people in our lives and the people listening to this podcast, it really brings to the forefront what is at stake when we start talking about getting better with money and having better conversations about money. The fact of the matter is, money is the leading cause of arguments in relationships and a primary factor of why half of marriages end up in divorce. So we wanted to spend some time talking about that subject so we can help others who may be in the middle or on the cusp of their own conflict. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten. Today we're talking about managing love and money.
Ooh.
If you've been following our story for a while, then at some point you may have heard us talk about the event that got us into learning more and talking about money. It's the story of our first conversation about money, which ultimately became an argument and then a breakup.
Yeah, my bad.
He broke up with me, by the way. But we're not actually going to revisit the conversation in this episode. You can look back into our content and hear more about it. I'm going to spare Julian from embarrassment and not dig into this into that argument into this episode. But we did want to talk about a recent article that was published in the September-October issue of Success magazine, and it's about the most common financial disagreements.
Yeah, I think this is a true testament to our growth as a couple and also your growth as a woman for just kind of letting it go.
You know,
letting the past be the past.
Going and full frozen.
Never speaking of it again.
There are
plenty of articles and podcasts. I don't think that we need to revisit that. I think we should just be forward-looking and start planning and thinking about our future. So let's start with just being present.
Yes.
And we're going to go back to what we said this podcast was going to be about, which is about a really interesting article. The article is by Emma Johnson, who is a business journalist, gender equality activist, and founder of WealthySingleMommy.com. The article is entitled, It's About the Money, Honey.
Yes.
Very clever. And it's, as you said, in the latest issue, well, at this time of recording it, the September-October issue, which always throws me off because we're in August right now.
I know.
And the September-October issue comes out. They're always like months ahead,
they're
which is normal.
Ahead.
It's not a success thing. That's just how the magazine industry works. Anyway, it's a really, really great article. And as you mentioned, it's a topic that is near and dear to our hearts because, quite honestly, it's one that almost destroyed our relationship. And the more I think about the people in our lives and the people listening to this podcast, it really brings to the forefront what is at stake when we start talking about getting better with money and having better conversations about money. The fact of the matter is, money is the leading cause of arguments in relationships and a primary factor of why half of marriages end up in divorce. So we wanted to spend some time talking about that subject so we can help others who may be in the middle or on the cusp of their own conflict.
You know, this may be a bit of a tangent, but it's still so wild to me that money is the leading cause of divorce, because when you think back to why marriage as an institution even exists, it was for money. It was literally an economic decision between families with the goal of like forming some sort of alliance.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've come a long way from that for many good and obvious reasons, like love matters. But it does go to prove what an enduring and like persistent topic money is. And it supports a lot of what Emma highlights in the article, which is that money matters in relationships primarily because it's been baked in there from jump.
Yeah.
It's always been a part of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really interesting thing. I don't know why my mind went straight to like sacrificing goats or giving people cows or something like that. I think that used to be a thing too. So like there's a good
and
bad
reason. Well, there
was a dowry. Yeah.
It wasn't sacrificing. It was like, I will give you this horse if you take my daughter from me. I mean, I don't think that was the exact quote. That's probably the drunk history version of how marriage used to happen back in the day. But yeah.
Someday I'll tell you what I gave your father.
No, he would have given you something.
Oh, it was the other way around?
Oh, wait, no.
Yeah,
I
would have given him like a cupcake or something.
Yeah.
And he would have like, here you go.
That's all you,
you can have it.
I'm only worth a cupcake, Dad.
He was just happy to get you off the payroll. completely different. That is probably true. Yeah, this is how times have changed. Okay, so let's jump into the article. It's a pretty easy one to wrap your head around, but what I really appreciate about it is that Emma isn't just speaking from personal experience. She's admittedly a divorced woman who is in a long-term cohabiting relationship with a divorced man. So obviously, this is personal for her. But she's also drawing insights from tons of research and surveys from her website she runs, which is the world's largest community of single moms. So she starts with a few absolute truths that people need to wrap their head around before they even try to resolve a financial conflict. And they're pretty simple. The first one is, as you've mentioned, money matters. Mm-hmm. It matters a lot, right? So let's stop pretending like it doesn't, or that our love for one another will always overcome any differences we have. Money absolutely matters. All of those other things are important too, but let's not forget money really matters in a relationship. The second one, she says, is that it matters who earns more, which is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. The third is that money disagreements will happen. The fourth is that money is a long game. So we shouldn't get so hung up on what we believe today, because our attitudes will change as our life changes.
Yeah. So I fully agree with most of these.
Okay.
The one that I really am 100% aligned with is that last one, which is that money is a long game. Whether you're in a relationship or not, I find that to be true.
Yeah.
Okay. So my parents just celebrated 41 years of marriage in May. And while they have given us a lot of advice about marriage over the years that we've been married, and many times it's been unsolicited, my favorite piece of advice from my dad is one that's called the 51% rule.
Here we go.
Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do.
I think he actually mentioned it in our wedding toast.
He probably did.
Yeah. So I'm going to explain it to y'all just because I think it's actually helpful and related. But basically, it's that whenever people get married, they expect to be happy most of the time. And his point is that mathematically, most is really just 50% plus 1, or 51%. And his theory is that that's what you should aim for. Like, nothing more, nothing less. Hence the 51% rule. See the way Julian's looking at me.
Brilliant math. I love it.
The 51% rule is basically his way of reminding couples to kind of lower their unrealistic expectations and to see marriage, like money, as a long game. There's going to be periods of 80% happiness that are followed by periods of 20% happiness due to things you really can't control, whether it's grief, illness, missteps, mourning. So whenever things get rocky, he reminds us of the 49% and says that the real work of marriage is simply making peace with its existence, because none of us are entitled to happiness all of the time. And because those highs and lows are so fluid, there's really no point in keeping score. Like, you really won't know what percentage you're at until it's over.
Yeah, so I agree with the math.
It's right? Pretty profound when you think about it.
51% is in fact greater than 49. That I cannot disagree with. That is universal law. I think my challenge with it is that it is just a dreary sort of approach. It's like, yeah, just accept the fact that just about half the time,
things are out of your control. Yeah.
You know, that's not how I interpret it. You know, it's more like it's like I'm being asked to accept misery for half of my life, and that it's not worth to fight about anything or argue or, you know, even try to find a peaceful resolution. That's, to me, I guess my issue is not so much with the way that the rule is constructed. It's more so how it's applied in real life.
Right. I mean, I think that his rule is ultimately applied to happiness, but the same logic can be applied to money. You can be doing all the right things and stuff still happens, you know, 49% of the time. You can
absolutely
be contributing to your Roth IRA. You can be, you know, putting things in your 401k, opening brokerages and 529s, but it doesn't stop your house from being flooded, your car from being totaled, your leg from being broken.
Yep.
And so it's really just making peace that, like, you only control your controllables, and the other half of the time, the world is going to do what it does.
Yeah, I think it's most relevant for people who really just double down on the love and feel like that's the thing that's going to guide them through any conflict that comes, no matter what. And it's like, yeah, sometimes that's not enough, right? Sometimes you've got to have, like, a real perspective. And if you are going to keep score, let's just keep in mind that technically you're doing okay if you're at just 40 or 51%.
Yeah. I forgot who said this, but they were talking about why they don't do a lot of long-term planning. And they said because planning only limits them to today's options. Mm. And I think that's true when it comes to money and acknowledging that it's a long game, that your options this year are going to be very different from your options 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Mostly because of the pace of the world and because money is not as consistent as we want it to be. It's not as, you know, all things even and constant as all of the formulas teach us that it is.
Yep.
Okay. So Emma then goes on and shares three of the most common sources or reasons for financial squabbles. And I really like these because I completely agree with all three of these. They are, the first one is disagreements over how much to spend or save, resentment over sacrificing a career.
That's
and
a
then
real one.
This third one, which was really interesting, which was primary breadwinner resentment. So I want to talk about them individually because there's a lot in each of these. And the first one, disagreements on how much to spend or save, I really liked her tips here because I felt like we could have written this ourselves. And this is exactly what we did to resolve our early morning fights, which sometimes they are early morning fights, but our early money fights. The first one is that each person needs their own money to spend without discussion, point blank. This was huge for us. I always felt like I was interrogated whenever we would try to do the budget together, full transparency, and I didn't have just my own kind of set of money to do what I wanted to do. And so I feel like this is a tip that every household needs, is that everybody gets their own discretionary spending money.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the part of the reason why people don't like that is because it feels like an allowance. And when people think about the term allowance, it makes them feel like they're
a child
or a teenager. And that sort of plays into the power dynamic that one person may have over the other. But yes, I completely agree with her approach on that. And to your point, that's something that we confronted pretty early in our relationship. The only thing I would add to that is there's a tendency to believe that whatever that amount is, it needs to be the same. And that's not necessarily true
at all.
Yeah,
we have very different amounts because we have very different needs.
Yep.
Okay, the second thing that she says is that you need to set common financial goals. And honestly, I didn't realize how rare shared financial goals were until we were recently talking to a couple that had been married over 14 years. And we learned that they didn't actually have any shared financial goals. They did have shared outcomes, which were kind of these vague ambitions, like we want to build generational wealth.
Yeah.
We want to make sure our kids don't struggle. But they hadn't translated that into like specific measurable goals. How do we get there? How much money is in their college accounts? How do we set up businesses in their names? Whatever that, you know, ladder to the outcome is, they hadn't really gone through that process of developing that.
Yeah. Now, since you've mentioned that, I think it's fair to say that it's actually a pretty cool and exciting opportunity. We obviously can't share everything, but the conversation that we had was actually filmed. It was for a television show, which we can't share quite yet. But as soon as it's made available, assuming that clip actually makes it, we will share that with the rest of the world so they can see us on TV talking to another couple about this exact subject.
Okay. And the last thing that Emma recommends is that you need to dig into your money stories. And this was a big one for us. When we did the tour de family, basically when I meet your people and you meet my people, we started to see like the embedded stories and traumas and quirks about money really start to come to life. Like once I met your mom and your dad and saw how y'all rolled, and you met my crazy family and saw how we rolled, it really started to make sense. Like, oh, okay, I see why you are the way that you are. Not in a derogatory way, but just like,
yeah, tell me
I
more.
See. I see why you, you know, do the things that you do. You get it straight, you know, the apple don't fall far from the tree, or however that phrase goes.
Yeah, sure. I'll roll with that. Agreed. I saw my fair share and made my fair share of connections between who you are and the trees you've fallen from. So
thank you.
You're welcome. That's called a compliment, by the way. All right. So let's dive back into the article. So According to Emma, the second most common source of conflict is resentment over sacrificing a career. And I absolutely love this because she spoke about the social pressure and the role that it plays in this creating this conflict. I'm going to quote her directly from the article because she mentioned two really critical points here. The first was Pew Research found that 60% of Americans believe it is best for kids when a parent is home full time.
Wow.
The second set of research she pulled was from the University of California study, which was that 35% of Americans believe that school-aged children are harmed when mothers, not fathers, just mothers, work outside of the home.
Wow.
So she flat out called this out as research that is based on stereotypes. And I couldn't agree more. Even as I was reading it, I was like, wait, just mothers? We're not even going to ask or like explore fathers? I feel like they may have done that intentionally to sort of get people riled up. But I do think that that really speaks to part of the challenges that we have here, because there's a bit of a rub between these social pressures, which, by the way, aren't always external. A lot of people believe these things.
Yep.
And if you do, we're just saying, hey, there's you need to sort of prepare for that to rub up against some of these other things that you may be trying to accomplish in your financial life. We have two recent experiences with this. One you just mentioned, but the other is going back to her point about breadwinning. We shot our own video series. And one of the talking points or parts of that discussion that was really interesting was when we were asking some of the other couples around the table, particularly the men, how they felt about us being during this time in this era where there are more women and mothers becoming breadwinners in the household. And I've always been fascinated by that dynamic because, again, it's where sort of money intersects with social change. And at least for the people that were at that table, they were pretty open to it. They were fine with it. They were team joint accounts and it's all going into one bucket.
But it's pretty. If you win, I win.
If you win, I win. Like, it's not about who wins. It's all about the team. If you're doing well, that's great. Or maybe you're in a season of winning and I'm taking a step back until I get back into my season. And so that sort of hybrid and blended approach is one that we take, and obviously we're a huge fan of. But it's clear, according to the data, that there's quite a few people that actually disagree with that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that it really depends on what you've seen role modeled in front of you. I think, to your point, a lot of the responses from that research were probably due to individual experiences that they've then kind of projected upon what they think about all women, all households, all children. And I feel like, you know, the more that we have examples of women and families who are making it work with two working parents and figuring out how to raise healthy, happy children in a world where sometimes the option to not work is not available to you, then the better off we are and the more like full examples we have of what breadwinning or what, you know, success looks like in the modern society.
And herein lies the challenge, because to that point, a lot of the men are doing just that. They're basing their modern day beliefs on what they saw modeled, which to your point was a reflection of probably 30, 40 years ago. Well, in some cases, maybe 50 or 60 years ago, right? And so there's a reason why grandma or your mom didn't work or couldn't work, because a lot of those opportunities may not have even been available to her, right?
Oh, yeah. And we were just talking about this at brunch with some of my girlfriends, that like the literal definition of work-life balance, you know, 30 years ago was that one person stays at home, one person works. Like it was not somebody trying to balance doing both of them. And so if that was modeled for you, you probably do have a skewed idea of like what work-life balance is and whether it exists, which is a totally different podcast, which we should record because I have some very new and emerging theories about whether it even exists. But I can see why you'd be modeling something off of, you know, modeling your life off of something that really just doesn't apply to today's world.
Yeah, it's a pretty complex issue. So I'm glad Emma dug into that.
Yes. Now, she also makes this third point about primary breadwinner resentment. And I want to dig into that after this quick break. So stay tuned. All right. The last source of financial disagreements in relationships is what she calls primary breadwinner resentment. And I don't know why I'm struggling with saying those three words, but I'm going to have to say them slow every time. So apologies to the listeners.
PBR.
PBR. Oh, I can do that. I was a big fan of PBR in college.
Yuck.
Don't judge. Do not judge me, listeners. Do not judge me. So this primary breadwinner resentment, or PBR, I'm going to quote Emma as well because it's written perfectly. She says, despite all the advances in policy and general acceptance of women and as professional equals in the world, the majority of us still believe that it is a man's job to bring home the bacon. This takes its toll. One recent study of married couples ages 18 to 32, so young married couples, found that men were the most stressed out and struggled with mental health when they were the sole breadwinner.
Can I just tell you that, like, makes me so happy?
Yeah.
Because we live in a world where, you know, again, talking about this intersection between personal finance and society or cultural and social pressures, you can't, as a man, right, if we're going to follow the standard definition, complain about how stressed you are or how tired you are. But the reality is a lot of us are sort of forced into this identity, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of pushed onto us from previous generations, and then it's reinforced by society, right? And so I completely agree with that as someone that has felt that stress. It is a really, really difficult one. And going back to our initial conflict about money, like, that also played a role in it. It was like, all right, this idea that I'm supposed to also fund everything and pay for everything, mm-hmm. because that's what makes me a gentleman and that's what makes me a real man, can be really, really difficult, you know? And I think a lot of men struggle with that. I think a lot of men struggle to admit that. And that's part of the reason why when they're forced to have those conversations, it really, really leads to conflict, mm-hmm. because all of a sudden we're already married. I've already accepted you as my partner in life, as potentially the mother or the father of my child. And now you're telling me that you're tired and you don't want to work anymore.
Right.
How are we going to fund everything that I've imagined and dreamed of in my mind? Yeah. How are we going to raise the child or the children, the multiple children mm-hmm. that we said that we wanted? How am I ever going to match up and be the person that I've always envisioned that I was going to be? Yeah. And I think that's why this article and this data and all of these sort of complex issues are really, really important. And that's why we're talking about it today.
Yeah. Reading this stat actually made me think of our situation a little bit, because I am naturally very competitive. And when I became the breadwinner and sole earner of our household, I was proud AF. Like, I was super excited to be able to say that, you know, I am helping you to fulfill our family dreams by, you know, you quitting work and me continuing. And at some point, it kind of lost its shine. And I guess I began to experience to some degree what I imagine the stress and the struggle that men experience. It was probably a little different for me because I was caught between two stereotypes and two social pressures. The one that says mom should be home raising kids while they're young. And then the other one that says women are professional equals in the workplace. I was kind of in between those two things. And I remember feeling like I was ready to quit and focus on our business full time, and just thinking that was a terrible idea and that nobody would support me and that I'm putting my family at risk. And a lot of that was in my head, but it was very, very loud. And so it made me feel like I was just stuck. And that's what led to the decline in mental health.
Yeah. And I remember you struggling with that. And I remember feeling like, I'll be honest, like, wow, like, I'm kind of glad that you're going through that, because mm-hmm. now I can remind you of what that felt like and say, well, this is how I feel whenever I am kind of going through my own struggles with that. But now that we're both sort of out of those environments, there's still pressure, let's be clear, as business owners. But we're fortunate in that we're focused long term. We're really not worried about, you know, whether or not we have enough money in the short term. It's really about, all right, can we achieve these goals? Some of these goals are personal. Some of them are because we just want to have an impact and support our community, or some of them are just creative. And so there's a different kind of pressure to sort of get things done and meet obligations, but it's not nearly as close to the sort of pressure that I think a lot of most people feel, which is just about, like, fulfilling the identity or who they want to be as a father or as a husband.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, they're concerned about how people are going to perceive them. So, yeah,
yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm glad you admit that, because I think that's really honorable for you. Yeah.
Yeah. I think personally, the resolution to any sort of resentment is a lot of inner work. It's a lot of doing some therapy or some journaling or some self-care, whatever it requires for you. But the tips that she gave in the article are also very practical and approachable, which is basically, you know, having candid talks about the division of household work, particularly around the tasks that fall in gendered roles. So traditionally, if you're in a heteronormative relationship, you know, do the women do all of the caretaking and the men do all the yard work, things like that. And then possibly exploring, maybe with a therapist, if that's what you all need, where those assumed roles came from. Like we said earlier, are you mirroring what you saw growing up? And does that really apply to the relationship and the family that you're building? And then she offers a big one, which is not being afraid to outsource. She basically says, you know, hire a housekeeper, a landscaper, order your meals, whatever you need to do to kind of take off some of the pressure at home where you can and allow you yourself some more room to breathe with some of the other pressures.
Yeah, those are all valid points. That last one actually makes me think of a previous podcast episode that we recorded, which was about the cost of getting a promotion. Mm-hmm. And so imagine a world where you've got a household where one person works, the other person decides to overcome this sort of stereotype or belief, and they get into the workforce. You could think of that as a promotion in a sense, right? Like you are getting a new job, this one creates income, but whatever sort of agreement or salary that you have, you've got to keep in mind that, okay, well, now that that one person isn't at home, a significant percent of that income is going to go towards some of those other things. And even if we're not just talking about calculating those things so that you can right size the budget, sometimes there's just value in being able to afford some relief, uh-huh, so that you have time to recharge your batteries so that you can still be productive at work and even at home and just still have the energy and the desire to do all of those other things. So it's really, really fascinating stuff. And I'm glad Emma wrote this article and shared some of the data and insights with our community.
Yeah. And if you want to read it again, it's in the September-October issue of Success Magazine, found at magazine and newspaper stands near you.
Start with Barnes and Nobles.
Or Barnes and Nobles.
Is there an S?
Is there
Barnes and Noble?
I always say the S.
There's several of
Barnes
them.
And Nobles?
I don't know.
I feel like Barnes gets an S. Nobles should get an S too.
Okay.
That's not how last names work, but for the purposes of this. Anyway, closing thoughts. So I love this article. I've actually met Emma a few times, and she is a straight shooter, just like she was in the article. She is a shot of whiskey. And I thought this advice was real and rare, especially in the relationship and money space. I think so often we default to love being like this magical cure-all for conflict, and that really only works in Disney movies. I think approaching conflict, particularly conflict about money and relationships, is in a far less romantic fashion is really the way to go. Here's a new theory I'm working on, is that you should approach money conflicts the same way and with the same problem-solving skills and tenacity that you would about a health concern. So if you suddenly developed a weird rash, you would start asking diagnostic questions like, what did I eat? Did I change my laundry detergent? Is a new perfume causing it? You wouldn't just immediately judge your body for reacting unfavorably. You try to get to the root cause to try and build an understanding of what's happening. Like, why am I now developing this rash? And a lot of her advice falls in that same vein. It's like, try to get to the root cause and kind of treat your money woes like you would a weird rash.
That's a horrifying visual. Thank you very much.
Rashes are not horrifying.
They are. And to all the listeners out there, I apologize if you were eating. All right. My thoughts are pretty similar. I thought it was a great article. I've not met Emma, but I've seen her online, and I would agree. She is a straight shot of whiskey. She's from the South, then we'll say bourbon. I'm not exactly sure. I don't believe I've met her. It would not surprise me if I have, because yeah, we've been traveling quite a bit. But yes, I love this article, and I think everyone should read it. I will also say, if you're in a relationship and you're struggling to queue up this conversation, don't feel like you're alone.
Right.
That is totally normal. These conversations can be super awkward, especially as you're just starting out in a relationship, because there is no real rule book for when you should actually have the money talk. But as you can probably guess, these conversations are absolutely necessary. I'll offer three thoughts here. First, Have the first one on neutral ground, like a park or somewhere wide open. Like Emma said, there is a power dynamic at play here. So if you're at one person's home or the other person's home, that sort of plays into their strength a little bit. And what you really want is for everyone to be on neutral ground. That helps to level the playing field. And I think it sets an environment for a much more productive conversation. The second is to keep in mind that the solution to finding that peace maybe to spend more money.
Ooh, I know it's counterintuitive
yeah. to think that, hey, whatever comes out of this conversation will lead to us spending less. But the answer just may be spending more. To your point about sort of doing some of the things that help to relieve pressure or recharge the battery, whether it's ordering in a little bit more, you can agree that that's going to be once a week or twice a week, or hiring out a cleaning service. All of those little things can actually be really, really great. So choosing to save more or choosing to pay for outsourcing services that improve quality of life or a relationship should both be viewed as positive contributions. The third one is, and I'll just leave it here, a bit of a third rail. While we spoke a lot about how these types of conversations conflict or intersect with social norms or cultural norms, we didn't talk about it, but they also conflict with religious norms. And that is something that you absolutely want to be respectful of. And you really, really want to be delicate. And that furthers the point why we think it's so important to have them, because it's better to learn some of these things about your partner as early as possible than to let these tensions or frustrations linger over time.
Love it. All right. You want to sign us off?
Sure. Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. If you like what you heard, except for the part about the rash, please grab yourself some ointment and leave a rating and review.
We'll see y'all next week.